thank you for the introduction, and it's great to be here. I'll be here at Perimeter for the rest of today and tomorrow, so if you want to come and talk to me, I'm more than happy to do so. Today I'll be telling you about an interesting story that's spread across roughly these three papers about an interesting effect in quasi-periodically driven systems, which allows you to prepare highly excited non-classical states of a cavity. So why would you want to do that? It turns out that these non-classical states can act as resource states, for instance, for doing highly sensitive metrology. So if you have, for instance, a Fock state, this is a quantum state of a cavity, it's an eigenstate of the number operator. This thing lets you perform highly sensitive measurements of phase. So if, for instance, you manage to load one of these Fock states into LIGO, then it would be much more precise at detecting gravitational waves, for instance. And so what I'm going to be telling you about is an effect in quasi-periodically driven systems that allows you to prepare these resource states at high number occupations, which makes them better resource states. So I'll begin by saying a bit about quasi-periodic driving. Why should you be interested in it? Well, I'll begin by saying, first of all, that periodic driving of, for instance, some quantum system here represented just by like a spin. Periodic driving is ubiquitous. It exists in basically every experimental setup. Whenever you want to deliver a signal to your system, it's just much easier to do it carried on top of some carrier frequency with some large frequency capital omega here. But of course, usually you want to apply a signal that varies in time. So for instance, you might want to amplitude modulate the height of this signal here. Maybe that can just be turning on the signal and turning it off, doing some kind of pi pulse on your qubit. And this means that there's going to be some other frequency, little omega, in the problem. And usually, in most experimental setups, these two frequencies are going to be separated by a very large width in frequency. And so it's legitimate to treat these two frequencies independently, and you can just pretend that the signal on this qubit is still periodic in some rotating frame with respect to this capital omega. And so, for instance, you can use Floquet theory to predict the response of the qubit. On the other hand, if there is, through some other constraint in your system, maybe there's only just like a particular bandwidth of frequency that you have access to, or maybe that for some other reason, you've decided that you want to put these two frequencies to be close together. In this case, there is no separation of scales. You can't treat these two omega frequencies as being independent. You have to treat them both simultaneously. And in this scenario, you can't use Floquet theory because, for instance, if the ratio of these two frequencies is an irrational number, then the resulting waveform on this spin is not periodic at all. In fact, it is only quasi-periodic. And so the question that we were asking in our group is whether operating in this regime can give you anything, right? Maybe the scenario from analyzing and developing the theoretical tools to treat this kind of regime of driving is just that, you know, experimentalists should just stay away from this. But actually that's wrong. There are interesting and useful things that occur in quasi-periodically driven systems. And in particular, I'll be talking about an emergent topological effect that can occur in systems exactly like this one, which will allow us to do something useful, namely prepare these highly excited resource states in some cavity. So I'm going to begin by talking about the effect, like the phenomenology of the effect that we'll be describing, and in particular, it's going to be called boosting. And then I will explain how we understand this effect through our kind of theoretical framework, and how we can predict it and see that it arises from a topological feature. And then the last part of the talk is going to be the non-adiabatic part of my title. How do we realize this boosting effect quickly? How do we do it outside of the adiabatic limit of very slow driving? Okay, but I'll begin just by explaining this effect called boosting. And to begin that, with that, I will first explain just the setup, the system that we're going to be interested in. So we're interested in cavity or circuit QED systems like this. So the idea is that we have some qubit, here represented by this black spin, coupled to a cavity, here represented by some sine wave between some mirrors, with an external drive, and the external drive is going to be circularly polarized. I'll say more about the precise Hamiltonian when I talk about experimental realizations of this setup. But for now, I'll just say a few things about the scales of in the problem. So there's this cavity frequency, which is going to be a little omega. There's this drive frequency from the red drive, which is capital omega. There's some amplitude of the fast of the capital omega drive, and there's some coupling between the qubit and the cavity. And I want to operate in, first of all, an adiabatic regime of parameters, which is to say that the two frequencies from the cavity and the drive are going to be the smallest scales in the problem. So we're driving very slowly. And furthermore, the ratio of these two frequencies is going to be irrational. So it's that there's no separation of scales that I'm assuming between little omega and capital omega. And the fact that their ratio is not a rational number that makes this a problem which is well suited for a description in terms of quasi-periodic driving. And you should all feel free to like, yeah, to interrupt me with questions at any time. Yes.
Oh, so G and B, what is the dimensionality of like inverse time, time?
They both have units of energy.
They both have.
Yeah, yeah. So inverse time.
Yes. Yeah. Can I ask what is the precise meaning of the coupling? You know, probably I don't know.
Sure. I mean, it's just if you like, it's the strength of the interaction between the qubit and the cavity. Within some, yeah, it's exactly that. Yeah, so if you like a strong coupling means that it's very easy to transfer like a unit of energy from the qubit. So like flip the qubit down and excite the cavity. That happens very quickly if G is large, and it happens very slowly if G is small. Okay, so with the setup described, I can now just show you the boosting effect, and you'll see exactly what it is through this movie, which I'm about to show you.
Isn't the energy splitting between the qubits another energy scale?
Between the qubit, you're asking about like where the qubit energy lives in this this hierarchy? Is that your question?
Kind of.
Yeah, I mean, it basically lives here. Like the only important part, really, is that these are the smallest scales in the problem. So the qubit energy is going to be kind of on the scale of B, if you like.
Okay.
Right. Okay, so the movie I'm about to show you, on the x-axis, I have the photon number, like the Fock index of the cavity, and I've loaded in some initial state with exactly 10 photons, so it's initially a Fock state. On the vertical axis is the probability for being in each Fock state. So right now it's just a single bar of height 1 at the photon number 10. And as I hit play, time is going to advance. Time here is being shown in units of the external drive, that capital omega. And you're going to see how does the state of this cavity evolve. And I'm tracing out the qubit. So let's see. So first of all, it initially just spreads into some broad mush. But there are two features I want you to notice. First of all, the entire distribution is moving towards the right. So it's moving up to higher photon occupations, the higher energies. Secondly, every now and then you're noticing that there are these spikes, these revivals in the photon distribution. Here's another one. So quasi-periodically, it turns out, there's these revivals in the distribution, where the distribution comes up to nearly a Fock state again. Let's watch the movie again so you can see those two features. Oops. So everything's moving to the right. We're pumping energy into the cavity. And secondly, quasi-periodically, there are these revivals in the distribution where the cavity state rephases to being almost a Fock state again. You can see here spiking up. There's going to be a small one now. There's going to be a much larger one just now. And everything's moving towards the right as it does this. And so it turns out that this is generic for any initial state which is narrow in photon occupation. So here are some stills from that movie, so you can see it again. In the first still, I have the initial state. I have a Fock state with a particular number of photons. At most intermediate times, it's just some broad mush, but it's moving towards the right. It's moving to higher occupations. And then at some particular times, everything rephases, and this thing jumps up to being almost a Fock state again. So this means that evolution under the Hamiltonian, which I was describing to you, in this cavity QED system with quasi-periodic energy scales, will take an initial state, which is well localized in photon number, and boost it, translate it in Fock space up to a higher occupation number. So this means that if you can prepare some interesting resource state at low photon occupations, you can then do this procedure and then boost the state up into higher occupations where it's a better resource state, where it gives you more power, for instance, for doing highly sensitive metrology. Here's the same data again, now shown as like a color plot. So on the x-axis, I have time. On the y-axis, I have the photon number. And then the color scale is showing the probability of being in a particular Fock state. You can see at first, everything's has unit probability to be in the state 10. Things spread out, but then increase with a particular rate, which I'm going to talk about. And then there are these particular times marked by blue arrows where the entire distribution pinches together into almost a Fock state again. So this is the thing that we want to explain through appealing to some topological effect, and that we're proposing is useful for preparing these highly excited non-classical states of the cavity. So the formalism that I want to adopt to explain this is called the frequency lattice. It's easiest to explain for the cavity first. So to begin with, what is our system? It's a qubit with some state sigma coupled to a cavity and an external drive. Because we're talking about an effect that is occurring in the photon number in Fock space, it's convenient to basically work in the Fock number basis of that cavity. And so if I'm writing the state now as the tensor product state of the qubit and the cavity state in the Fock basis, here N1, then I can think of this as being like a tight binding model for some excitation, which is hopping around on this lattice with two orbital degrees of freedom given by the spin states, right? So that is to say, like, I'm imagining that the Fock state number is like a lattice index of some excitation that's wandering around this chain. So that's how I want to treat the cavity. And I actually want to treat the classical drive in the same way. So there's something formal I can do in terms of the Fourier transform, which will show you that actually it's good enough to replace this external classical drive by a similar kind of lattice dimension, like I ended up with for the cavity state. But it's maybe more intuitive to see if I imagine that this external drive is coming from the classical limit of another cavity. So I can engineer a classical drive by having another cavity, which I take as being in a very highly excited but classical state with a small coupling.
And so, cavity, you don't want to treat it classically, right? So
I'm sorry.
For the original cavity, you don't want to treat it classically, right?
That's correct.
There will be a minimum number of photons.
That's right. So there's some indeed. So there's some ground state down here. Yeah, and so like the treatment that I'm describing was originally pioneered for both drives being classical, and what I guess originally this paper realized was that it works also for like the quantum case when one of the things is really a cavity. But regardless of the vacuum existing for this thing, there is some formal treatment where you imagine that this thing is a cavity with a large number of photons. This is what Dom meant by saying like there's like a minimum number of photons. If you're treating this thing as having a very large number of photons, then you can't reach that minimum. Okay, but then you once more move to the Fock number basis of this external drive, and you end up introducing a second lattice dimension. Right, so now the complete state, which I'm using to describe my system, is described by the qubit state sigma, the initial cavity state n1, and this fictitious cavity that I introduced n2. And so this is just a formal correspondence between the system of interest, this cavity QED thing, and this now lattice model, which is more amenable to techniques that we're familiar with from the rest of condensed matter. So this construction lives under the name of synthetic dimensions. It's a way of engineering the physics of a higher dimensional model, here 2D, through the dynamical response of a lower dimensional model, here a spin coupled to a cavity. Okay, so how do we translate the effect that we're trying to explain into this lattice language, which is going to let us leverage our condensed matter intuition and tools? So to begin with, let's just think about the initial state. Like, what did we start with when we were working with the original problem? So we had some spin state. I guess I ignored it. It's not super important. But we started with an initial eigenstate of n1. So I started with a state that is kind of well localized on this in this lattice on like a single horizontal strip, which I'm here just drawing as a blob. And second of all, we started in a classical state of the capital omega external drive. And it turns out that that means that we should basically have a Gaussian profile in the N2 direction. Yes, it would be quite wide. Yeah, so it's not, I haven't drawn it to scale. Yes, it would be quite wide.
Direction, you don't want to model the state.
Yes, like it will end up not being so important exactly what it looks like in the N2 direction, but yeah, it's essentially a coherent state. But like with large occupation, which is why I said Gaussian. In principle, it's some Poisson, but for large N, it looks Gaussian.
So what's the meaning of the second direction?
This N2 direction. So you can really think of it as the number of photons in the external drive, right? So imagine that I took my external drive and I put it between some mirrors. I'm really tracking like the energy in that field. That's what N2 is counting. Okay, so this is my initial state. It's some like wave packet in this synthetic lattice. Okay, the second thing to observe is that each of these cavities, the original cavity and the one I introduced for the external drive, come with some cavity energy, right? There's a frequency, there's an energy of the cavity, which is just, as presumably everyone remembers, it's just like there's some omega 1, n1, which I guess I was writing before is little omega, and there's another energy from the external drive to do with the other dimension, which is like capital omega n2. So in terms of this lattice language, that just looks like a linear potential in this lattice. So I could imagine it arising from some kind of constant electric field in more condensed matter language.
Is it important that the energy of the photon is proportional to the number?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's important that there is a linear potential in this lattice. That is crucial to the effect that we're going to be describing.
So if I engineer some strange cavity such that there's strong self-interactions between the photons. Will the revival physics?
Well, I guess it's important that there is an electric field, not necessarily that the electric field is constant. So what you're describing would still be arising from something which I could interpret as an electric field, but it would be changing in space. Mm. So that's not important. The effect will still occur with that happening. Yeah, good question. Okay, so what do we have? We have a wave packet. It's living in a lattice. It's got an electric field. The circular driving, which I said that we had for the external drive, turns out to give this lattice a churn number. So when I have a wave packet in a lattice with a churn number and an external electric field, I get a Hall response, right? So when I start this wave packet here and I let it evolve under this electric field, there's a current which is perpendicular to the applied electric field, right? That is the Hall effect. I start with something with a churn number, I apply an electric field, and my electrons go perpendicular to it. And so let's translate this Hall current, which happens in this lattice language, back into the original cavity system that we were talking about. So I started with some N1 and some N2. I ran along this diagonal perpendicular to the electric field. And in doing so, I went down in N2. I reduced the number of photons in the drive. And I went up in N1. I increased the number of photons in the cavity. So this Hall current is really like this energy pumping effect that I was talking that we were pointing out before. We're increasing the number of photons in N1. We're moving to the right in this movie. So that's part of the effect explained. And actually, it also explains the rate of energy pumping. If you just translate the quantized Hall current into a quantized energy current back in the lattice language, you get that it has some dimensionful prefactor, but it's proportional to this churn number in this lattice.
Sorry, can you remind me again whether N2 is bounded from below?
It is not.
N1
is.
If you somehow have to be also sign the return of it, you can go eventually hit the barrier at the minimal N1.
Yes, that can happen. And like when you hit the, it's like a conveyor belt. When you're living in one churn number state, and you're moving towards the minimum energy, it's like you're moving like the opposite direction to what I drew. Then you come towards the minimum energy, then you flip, and then you go up. And there's actually some maximum you can pump to as well, where you flip again. And you just go back and forth. Yeah, also a good question.
So I think I missed. According to this picture, I think you only go up in water. How do you go down?
If C was minus C, you would go the other direction.
Sorry, what determines C?
The exact form of the driving, which I haven't written yet. But yeah, like basically the Hamiltonian, which I'm going to write down soon, will determine C.
To define the churn number, do you assume something band structure on this lattice system? Or similar stuff?
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's the churn. It's the band structure in the absence of the electric field is the churn number that I'm talking about. And yeah, like keep that question in mind because I think I'm going to return to it. I'll address that in greater detail later. Okay, but there was another effect to explain in this boosting phenomenon, not just the energy pumping. There was also this rephasing, this revival of the state. So can we also explain that through this frequency lattice analogy? And the answer is, again, yes. So there's another effect that wave packets do in electric fields, which is Bloch oscillations. When you start in a wave packet in an electric field, it not only has this anomalous velocity where it is transported perpendicular to the electric field, if there's a churn number, it also has some center of mass oscillations parallel to the electric field. Turns out that when your wave packet is extremely well localized, like I imagine this one is, usually it doesn't just have center of mass oscillations. You can imagine it kind of splitting up into separate wave packets, each of which have separate center of mass oscillations. So it ends up looking more like a kind of breathing motion where the wave packet expands and contracts and expands and contracts rather than moving back and forth. So this breathing effect is the same breathing that we saw in the movie. The wave packet expands, and then quasi-periodically it comes back together. The quasi-periodic turns out to be because this electric field is in an incommensurate direction to the lattice. If it was in a direction commensurate to the lattice, it would be periodic, but it's only quasi-periodic because of that. Okay, so it's the combination of these two effects, this Hall current and this breathing, these block oscillations, yeah, rephases quasi periodography, which gives us the boosting phenomenon. So as a kind of cartoon, the wave packet splits up, starts expanding. As it does so, it has this anomalous velocity, it's moving with its whole current, and then periodically, quasi-periodically, it rephases into being the same thing again. And when you project that picture onto the N1 axis, it looks like this. So as time progresses, the wave packet expands, it's still moving to the right, it's still moving up in N, and then quasi-periodically, it comes back together when these Bloch oscillations pull everything back together. Yes?
If the frequencies are not very rational because of each other, would this vary by periodically, or would it completely?
So you're asking if the frequencies were rationally related? Okay, so first of all, if they're rationally related with like a very large denominator, then at short times, basically short times short compared to that denominator in some units, it will look exactly like this. At times longer than that, you will notice that the the rate at which each wave packet moves is not exactly this. It's kind of this on average, but if they're not irrationally related, then each wave packet can in principle have a slightly different rate of pumping, and so they'll asymptotically separate.
So there won't be any forbidden boosting? Is that what might happen?
So yeah, you will have energy pumping from the drive into the cavity, but these rephasings will get worse in time. So oops. These rephasings, these will start to be broader in time.
So it is the average photon number still increases on average to infinite times?
Yes. Well, infinite times. There's like a cap on how far it can increase. Basically where the, because like the Hamiltonian depends on n, if you like the effective model on the qubit, it has parameters that drift in n. So when n becomes large enough, it exits the topological regime. But until that time, yes, it can pump.
Well, that's because if you treat the cavity as one of the classically,
yeah. Oh, classically, yes.
I would have thought that the rational feelings that eventually the system comes back to where it started or something.
I don't think so.
What if it's just like a small rational number, like omega equals capital omega is omega over 2 or something?
No, I mean like the pumping rate will do what you're describing, right? It will like come back to itself and repeat periodically. But it can have like a non-zero average value, right? So this plot will still increase even when the rationally related frequencies. Okay, so that's boosting.
Bloch oscillation, what are those two
wave
packets?
Bloch oscillations, usually derive them by thinking about, let me describe it in like momentum space, where it's conventionally discussed. So like I think about some Brillouin zone, I'm just going to have a square, k2, k1. And I think about preparing some wave packet in the lattice, which is to say, it's kind of decently well localized in both K space and in real space. For this case, this is the thing which does center of mass oscillations. When you're really well localized in the lattice, like much smaller, like basically on the scale of the lattice spacing, then you can't be this well localized in momentum space. You end up looking something like that. And this thing does not do center of mass oscillations. Instead, you have to like think about it as, you know, like a bunch of different kind of small packets. And each of these things does center of mass oscillations, but they do them out of phase. So when one of them is moving forward, one can move, the other one can like move backwards. And it ends up being this kind of breathing motion. Okay, so something which I would like to emphasize about this effect is that it's actually like very, very close to experimental reality, right? Like the system which I have described is like totally routine in many setups. So for instance, if I'm considering a particular realization, I might consider like a superconducting qubit architecture, or perhaps a more conventional cavity QED optical setup where I have like literally an atom inside like a light field trapped between two mirrors with an external laser. But the experiment that we've been working with in trying to realize this is using superconducting qubits, where the couplings are naturally larger. So the Hamiltonian will end up looking something like this. There's some cavity energy here, which I've decomposed into a qubit energy, which belongs to this term, this like sigma z splitting on the qubit, plus some detuning, which is the little omega, which is the slow variable. There's the superconducting qubit itself with its energy, which is being periodically modulated with some different frequency capital omega. There's Jaynes-Cummings coupling. This is the usual kind of coupling that occurs in these superconducting qubits.
So why do you use Jaynes-Cummings coupling instead of a dipolar coupling?
Basically because, give me 2 seconds. The next term is going to be an amplitude modulated drive sitting on top of some carrier frequency given by the qubit frequency. And the reason why we can use the Jaynes-Cummings coupling rather than the Rabi coupling, the dipolar coupling, is because we're going to work in a rotating frame with respect to this omega q. And so this is the slow part of the coupling. Then there are these counter-rotating terms in the dipolar coupling, which it's legitimate to ignore within the rotating frame if there's this separation of scales between omega q and like the rest.
So it's important that omega q is much larger than g times squared. Right?
Yeah, but it's important, but this is also like the easy case, right? If you like working with the dipolar coupling really needs you to have g being quite large. I consider it a bonus that this can work with the Jaynes-Cummings coupling, which requires significantly weaker g's.
I think this is also related to Dominic's previous question. If n gets larger, under the pumping, then g times square root of n may be larger than omega q.
Yes. That's true. But even if that doesn't happen, there is like a cap on how big this can be while you still see this pumping. Like even well before this omega q potentially.
Okay.
But yeah, that's also a good observation. Yeah, what really ends up limiting these experiments seems to be the cavity lifetime, right? As you go to higher and higher cavity occupations, the state lasts for less and less long. So that's really what sets the limit on the experiment rather than anything else.
Also, the qubit may have some spontaneous emission.
Into the cavity, you mean? I think that's accounted for by this Hamiltonian. Or do you mean like out of the cavity, like through some other channel?
Yeah, to the
vacuum. Yes, indeed. There may be some like other relaxation mechanism for the qubit. That will spoil these rephasings that I'm talking about. No, I take it back. Yeah, that'll kill the effect. Okay, so like I said, we're working with an experimental group trying to realize this to like show that like you know it's really possible. In particular, the group is that of Alicia Kohler at the University of Maryland. The grad student Martin Ritter is really the one that's been leading the charge on this. It's still early days. Here's a picture of one of their chips that they've been using to design this system, which I showed you on the previous slide. With the cavity that they're going to boost the state of. And right now, they're basically just working on controlling the qubit properly. So to implement the scheme, which I showed on the previous slide, you need to be able to do some amplitude modulated signal in the X quadrature as well as being able to modulate the qubit frequency. And so like here are some plots that they've made of the color bar should basically be thought of as the probability of being in the excited state of the qubit. The x-axis is the drive frequency, this omega, the frequency of this drive. And the y-axis is time. So they've basically been mapping out what can they do through during these different kinds of modulation. And the next step is like put these things together and then boost the cavity. Was that a question? No? Okay, don't worry about it. okay, so I'm about to move on to the second half of the talk, which is about how to do this non-adiabatically through a topological effect in a higher dimensional system. But are there any questions about the first half of the talk about boosting so far? Okay, and I can move to the second part. Okay, so there are two, here I've drawn as a kind of cartoon, the steady states in this frequency lattice model. So they carry a current, there's some one with a Chern number plus one, and there's some with a Chern number minus one. And if I start a wave packet, you know, I'm kind of mostly overlapping with this plus one state, it's going to move along in the direction which I was showing you before. And if I started one with a wave packet mostly in this minus one state, mostly with overlap on this minus one state, it's going to move down in the opposite direction to what I was showing you before. And this comes back to the question which I was asked before, like what do I really mean the Chern number of, right? Because this is a picture that makes the most sense when this electric field is really weak, right? When I'm really picturing this as just like a linear response on top of some translationally invariant background, like I can talk about band structures and Chern numbers. Generically, if I have a non-zero electric field, then I'll get kind of scattering events between these two counterpropagating current carrying states. And without any kind of fine tuning, these two states will just hybridize into some kind of long loop with a total Chern number of zero. And so without fine tuning, this means that I'm really limited by the size of this electric field. I can only keep this electric field being really weak if I want to be able to do boosting, which means that my frequencies need to be really small, which means that boosting is not going to happen quickly, right? I'm only going to be putting energy into the cavity very, very, very slowly, which is not good because there's only some finite lifetime of this experiment which will limit, you know, how high an occupation you can get to. Okay, so how can we get around this? How can we non-adiabatically manifest this boosting phenomenon?
What's the scale that determines adiabatic speed flow compared to what?
These like basically the coupling and the scale of the amplitude modulation on the qubit. I mean, really, it will in the lattice language, it will be the gap between the bands, of course. But that gap ends up being set by G and B. Okay, so one way around this is to achieve these pumping modes as the edge modes in a topologically driven, in a topological model, right? So let me describe it. I'm gonna take some fermionic type binding model, which is here just like this sequence of squares. And I'm going to quasi-periodically drive it. And through some judicious choice of driving, this quasi-periodically driven model, it's going to turn out, has edge modes, which are going to accomplish this pumping between the different cavities. So like just to spell it out, by like drawing this blue wavy line, I mean that there's an edge mode which is localized here, such that if I prepare a fermion sitting in that edge mode, then this fermion will like absorb photons from capital omega and emit them into little omega. It's going to conduct this energy current between the two drives. And there's the opposite mode on the other side. And then I'm furthermore going to engineer this model so that it's localized in the bulk, which means that this isolated edge mode over here cannot scatter with this one on the other side. This is exactly the same physics as you would see in like a churn insulator. Right? There are these edge modes, which in principle should scatter off each other and stop carrying current. But because they're separated by this gapped bulk, they can continue to do this just on the edge by themselves. Okay, so I guess I said it kind of schematically in this slide, but it turns out that there's a very cute model for how to do this, which has some like analytically solvable limits, which we can analyze cleanly. So this model is based on some coupled layer construction. I'm going to start with an array of fermionic sites, which for now are decoupled. And each of these sites, I'm going to drive with this drive that you saw before, but I'm going to fine tune it such that each of these sites really supports a mode which pumps in one direction or the other. So these churn number states, I've done whatever fine tuning I need to have these things really be living forever on each of these sites. So if I yep.
I think I'm very confused now. Mm. So previously we were talking about one qubit.
Yes.
Now are we talking about a fermionic lattice and each site is viewed as a qubit?
Yes, so I'm talking about single particle fermion physics, where I can regard each site as having a spin degree of freedom, so it's like spin full fermions. And I'm saying that when I start my fermion here in the up state, then I do this pumping. And when I start my fermion here in the down state, then I do this orange pumping in the other direction. So, restricting the fermion to a single site, then it is indeed like a two-level system, right? Up and down. But I now have this lattice of like other modes that the fermion could live in, each of which pumps, but in opposite direction. So yeah, like thank you for clarifying.
About the cavity, is there a single cavity at each site?
Yeah. So, I guess I've been a bit glib. Yeah. So I could again like draw mirrors around this omega, and I basically just like replace the drive, which I'm describing here with a coupling to a cavity.
So is there only one cavity, or each site has a cavity?
There is only one cavity. Every site is coupled to the same cavity. Yes.
Sorry, maybe I guess the fact that there is an impact fermions, not holes,
Well, at the single particle level, it doesn't matter. The reason we like to think about fermions is because it provides a clean way to make sure that you occupy this mode, right? You can basically start with a domain wall state where you fill all the fermions up to some distance and then nothing above that distance. And then you for sure have like maximum overlap with this localized mode at the edge. And then nothing in the bulk pumps. So this is like an easy way to prepare a state which pumps if you can do this. And it's fermionic.
So just to make sure, is not a physical system just a fermionic system with fermions localized at sites?
It's a fermionic type binding chain with localized fermions.
So I guess it doesn't matter if this is just a bosonic system with 2 degrees of freedom.
Indeed, this same stuff, because it's all like single particle physics, which I'm talking about right now, yes. Or a bosonic system that will also do this same thing if you can like prepare the right initial state.
I guess I'm asking whether the fermions move. Whether the only degree of freedom is the spin of the fermion.
No, the fermions can move between different sites.
But they can.
They can. Okay, as I'm about to show, right? So I started with this chain with decoupled sites where they couldn't move, but then I'm going to introduce some hopping term, which is dimerized, so that there's some intra-cell hop between this up-pumping mode and this down-pumping mode, as well as an inter-cell coupling between some up down pumping mode and up pumping mode on the adjacent site.
And maybe what Ludwig was asking is that should always be able to do a Jordan Whitney transformation on this and try to make it some spin, purely spin model.
This is true. In 1D, that's also true. So there is some somewhat unnatural looking, I think. I mean, it'll be local and everything. So maybe not so bad. Hamiltonian in terms of spins, which does the same things. That's true. Okay, I'm introducing these hoppings. In the limit where the inter cell hopping is zero, so I set this tuning parameter epsilon to zero, and I only have this intra cell scattering, and I'll generically form some kind of trivial state where I just hybridize each of these two modes and I leave nothing at the edges. On the other hand, I tune epsilon to one, so I left with only this term here, then I'm still going to hybridize and scatter these adjacent modes, but now I do it in a way that leaves behind these dangling edge modes. And so this is the topological regime with epsilon equals one. And you'll notice also that in doing this, I form these kinds of circulating loops of energy in the bulk. This is actually another real feature, which is shown in this cartoon.
By the way, do we need to add the Hermitian conjugate to this Hamiltonian?
Yes. So there's some plus HC. Okay, so these are two like analytically solvable limits where I can say for sure epsilon equals zero is in the trivial phase, epsilon equals one is in the topological phase. The whole model, by the way, is just like the SSH chain in some rotating frame, right? So this kind of construction should be familiar. But away from these two limits, we really need to resort to some extent to numerics to map out the phase diagram. The model has, I mean, much like the SSH chain, it has some self-duality, which maps epsilon to one minus epsilon. So if there's a unique critical point, it has to be at epsilon is exactly one half, separating a trivial regime where there's no pumping at the edges from a topological regime where there is pumping at the edges. But like the localization length of these edge modes is increasing and diverges at the critical point. And so doing numerics, we get a map of the average pumping rate here, P bar, in units of the topological pumping rate as a function of this tuning parameter epsilon. And we can see indeed it is zero below some critical value, and it is one above that value. And finite size scaling on this crossover regime here suggests that this is indeed sharpening up into a step function. And that this is really a sharp transition between the trivial regime and the topological regime. And in fact, it looks to be to have the critical exponents of the integer quantum Hall transition in 2D. And I guess we can talk about why that might be if you're interested in. Though we don't have a clean and complete theoretical explanation of that. We only have kind of inklings. Okay, but to be clear, this means that in the topological regime, where there are these edge modes which pump non-adiabatically, you can prepare some particular initial state over here of fermions and use it to do this pumping effect, this boosting effect, non-adiabatically, and prepare highly excited non-classical states of your cavity very quickly. In the last few moments before I have to stop, I'll say a little bit about the topological classification which underlies this particular model which we constructed, a classification which I guess we actually worked out first before we came up with the model. Let me first of all distinguish how this classification differs from other single particle fermion classifications, which are usually classifications of gaps in the spectrum, just like the usual periodic table of topological insulators that people construct is found by specifying a gap in the spectrum and asking what deformations of the Hamiltonian do not close that gap. Similarly, for Floquet topological insulators, you can specify a gap in the quasi-energy spectrum after you get by like folding the single particle spectrum, and asking that gap also does not close. For quasi-periodically driven models, the same folding procedure that you do in the Floquet case basically gets repeated many, many, many times until the spectrum becomes dense. So there are actually no gaps in a formal sense in a quasi-periodically driven system. So we need some other principle for how to distinguish different topological phases. The principle we use is that the states have to be localized. So following through the same kind of exercise that people do for topological insulators, you draw some phase diagram, which for us is going to consist of all capital D tone quasi-periodic single particle type binding models, the fermions. So by D tone, I mean it's quasi-periodically driven with capital D fundamental frequencies. And out of this whole phase diagram, I'm going to carve out those which are localized, both in the real dimensions and in these synthetic frequency lattice dimensions. And so if I know that if I start, for instance, over here in some Hamiltonian, which is completely localized, then I can't, through some variation at some slow change of parameters, transform that into something over here without passing through a delocalization transition. So if I can identify some topological invariant or some way of distinguishing these connected components in this phase diagram, then it would be reasonable to call such a thing a localized topological phase. For reasons which I now somewhat regret, we also added the word anomalous onto that name. So the full acronym is ALTP, which I will use from now on. This is terminology inherited from Floquet topological insulators, where the ones without churn numbers get called anomalous. I don't think it has anything to do with anomalies in field theory.
So is localization a property of HT?
Of what?
H of T.
Yes. So like, I mean, yeah, you can work out the steady states of H of T and ask, are they localized? Right. And so indeed you can find a topological invariant which distinguishes these different phases. It turns out to be the same for any case where the number of dimensions in the type binding lattice and the number of external drives sum to the same number. So it's some winding number invariant. If you've seen these things before, then presumably this looks familiar. If you haven't, then I don't think it's super useful for me to go through it in great detail. I think the more insightful observation is again evoking the frequency lattice to see why this should only depend on the sum of the number of dimensions and the number of tones. Because for each of these models on the left-hand side here, a qubit driven by three tones and a wire driven by two tones, and even a Floquet system, a 2D lattice driven by one tone, the frequency lattice construction, which exchanges these drives for additional spatial dimensions, produces more or less the same model for each of these physically very, very different original models in the temporal domain. We get the same kind of frequency lattice. So from the point of view of us doing a topological classification just of these frequency lattice models, it's kind of much more natural that each of these physically distinct systems should belong to the same kind of element of the classification, or if you like, that the classification of each of these things should be the same. In particular, there's an integer invariant for each of these odd dimensional cases, and in the even dimensional cases, it's trivial. Okay, so I think I'm more or less out of time, so I will conclude. To summarize, I've told you about this method of boosting cavity states where you can use a topological effect derived from quasi-particle driven systems to prepare highly excited non-classical states of a cavity, which are useful, for instance, for doing highly precise metrology with, for instance, Fock states. I also told you about how to do this very quickly, how to do it non-adiabatically by using the edge states in a topological phase of quasi-periodically driven fermions. Something I'd really like to emphasize is that this is in immediate experimental reach. Certainly the qubit version, which I talked about, I think can be done like straight away. The lattice version with the topological 1D model with external driving is a little bit more challenging, but I also think that it's by no means prohibitive. We're pretty sure, yeah, we have, I think, strong arguments that the 1 plus 2, that is to say, 1D wire driven by two tones, ALTP, is stable to weak interactions. So that basically, it can be many body localized. Modulo all sorts of debate that has been going on in the MBL community. And this, for instance, is the phase which does this boosting effect. So this is a particularly useful one to be stable. We think it's not true for higher numbers of dimensions in either one or two. So either more tones or more dimensions, we don't think it's stable. There's all sorts of future directions that we're interested in. I described like a particular technological application of this 1 plus 2 ALTP. It'd be interesting to see if there's something similar for like the higher dimensional ALTPs. We haven't done any kind of classification of these ALTPs with symmetry, but we think it's totally possible. There's absolutely no impediment, and we think it's definitely doable. I mentioned very briefly that the critical point in this phase diagram, which I showed you, we have some like preliminary basic understanding of that critical point, but like it's not at all precise. And there's, I think, probably some interesting physics to uncover there.
Sorry, can I
yep.
For the stages of interaction phase,
yep.
So you mentioned that we can argue that MDL phase, that MDL is stable. It's clear that with interaction is still distinct from some kind of trivial state.
So let me not say that it's clear, but nonetheless, we believe it to be the case. I mean, Dom has some classification of interacting quasi-periodically driven systems with like which are short-range entangled. This is a localized, so it should be short-range entangled. Maybe prosaically, because there are these chiral modes on the edge, like these like uncompensated modes, I don't think that you can add interactions and eliminate them, right? My understanding is that when you have like the cases where you can like remove these edge modes through adding interactions and like the interactions cause the classification to be reduced, usually come with like helical modes for like there's something else to get rid of the other thing, which before would have been like forbidden through some reason. Here there's really nothing to get rid of this, so I don't see how you could add interactions here and cause this thing to go away. Okay, so like I said, I will be here for the rest of today and tomorrow. Last I checked, there was plenty of space in my schedule. So I'm happy to talk with anyone about any of my past work or about your own work, even if it's on something completely different. Most of my recent work has lived under the umbrella of non-equilibrium quantum dynamics. Of course, you've heard all about this program of quasi-periodic driving that we've been doing. I also have some recent work on slowly thermalizing systems, kind of pre-thermal MBL, as we've called it. I have this very recent paper on an integrable model of nitrogen vacancy centers coupled to their environment. So if you want to talk to me about integrability, I'm more than happy to do so. And as maybe you got a flavor of in this talk, I have a longstanding interest in topology, which has kind of infected the rest of my work. And so I'm also more than happy to talk to anyone about any of these things, or as I said, anything even unrelated. Okay, I'm over time, so I'll just finish by thanking all these people. Don Vina, who's another grad student in my advisor Anusha's group. Bill Crowley, her former postdoc, who's now at MIT, soon to move to Harvard. Alicia, our experimental collaborator, and her grad student, Martin Ritter. All of these people were very helpful. And thank you all for listening.
Right, any questions?
I think I'm confused by something basic. So how do we see the connection between quasi-periodicity and the topological effect? How to see the intuition behind these two things?
Well, maybe I'll say it. Quasi-periodicity gives you this synthetic dimension. Yeah, so quasi-periodicity gives you a way to like access these synthetic dimensions. And it's these synthetic dimensions which host the topological effect, right? So somehow the quasi-periodic driving is emulating the topological response of a higher dimensional thing in this like lower dimensional like qubit or wire, which would otherwise not have been accessible.
But as long as you have two frequency mode, you can also already have two dimensions, right?
Oh, so you're saying why quasi-periodic? Why couldn't I have like commensurately related? Yeah, okay, that's a good question. So if you're more careful about doing this mapping, in the case where these are really drives and not cavities, then this thing ends up being periodic around the perpendicular direction where these currents are running. So rather than being like a plane like I've drawn it, it ends up being like a cylinder, where this is like the electric field direction and this is like the current direction. And certainly like, yeah, you can have also topology in this geometry. But you end up with essentially what amount in this picture to finite size effects, which are absent in the quasi-periodic version.
Oh, I see.
But no, like it's a good observation. For just this physics, you can also use commensurately related frequencies. It ends up just being like less robust, I would say. There end up being like other things which can occur at longer times. Things are not self-averaging. It's more difficult to see like the quantization of the topological response.
So you're saying that if you consider periodic, I mean the ratio is a rational number.
Yes.
I can still see the topological effect, just some finite time or finite size effects, right?
Yeah, like basically there are additional details you need to worry about, but in principle, like you can work out those details.
Uh-huh.
It's not as clean.
Uh-huh. I see.
And we can talk more if you really want. Yeah, I can explain more. But yeah, yes. Like the brief explanation is that like you open up yourself to finite size effects.
I see. Uh-huh.
Actually, I have now understood where this Chern number comes from for the qubit.
Sure. It's basically the model I wrote down. I chose it appropriately to have a Chern number. If you take this model in the rotating frame and you write out its frequency lattice model, you will see that it is actually just a BHD model. I basically chose this Hamiltonian to emulate the BHC model. So like basically I chose this carefully so that it had a Chern number. And I guess how you can see it, it's to do with the circular driving. Doesn't look circular here, but once you go into the rotating frame, it becomes circular. And so in the frequency lattice, you end up with these sequences of like hops and spin flips, which can enclose flux.
So Hamiltonian is not in the rotating frame?
No, I have not done the rotating frame transformation yet on this Hamiltonian.
Then where is the cosine omega qt?
This is the thing will disappear in the rotating frame. So like you write the rotating frame transformation, you write Sx as being Sx goes to Sx cos omega qt plus Sy sine omega qt. I think. Okay, maybe I can't do it live. But the basically this sorry, not Sx. I got that wrong. It was I don't remember what I did wrong. It's S plus S plus I. Yeah. Okay. You do something like this. And basically you end up canceling once you do the you can separate this out into like fast and slow modes. I guess I somewhat fumbled the doing it on the board, but we can talk more if you're interested. I will get it right if I do it slower. and the slow modes in this thing end up being the corresponding to like a circular drive. And this is the thing which gives you the Chern number.
So in the rotating frame, is the time dependent?
Yes. Yes. It still carries this amplitude modulation.
Then the Chern number comes by considering the model with B equal to zero.
No, you should have positive B. B should be in the scale. That model will have a Chern number.
I thought Chern number is some property of a time-independent half-time.
Well, it's the frequency lattice model that has a Chern number in that language.
Okay.
You can also think about just like the field experienced by the qubit as a function of like the drive phases. And that field will like wrap around the sphere, and so it has a Chern number. Just like viewed as a map from the torus to the sphere, that thing has a Chern number. Yeah.
It's not a Chern number, it is a decay energy, right? It's a different Chern number, right?
It coincides for the two band case. But yes, in this case it's the decay invariant.
All right, what I mean is decay invariant is defined in momentum space. So like to the computer, not compute core conductance, so it's not what you're doing here.
In the sense that it's not in momentum space. I mean the map I described from being like drive phases, that is like the analog of that is like the conjugate variable to these ends.
Not
necessarily
computing
a core
conductance of the actual system. Anyway.
Of the actual, indeed. Like it works through analogy, like maybe treating this frequency lattice more literally it is indeed an analogy based around this frequency lattice picture. But it is, I think, just the whole conductance of the frequency lattice model. If you like really wrote down this as like an actual type binding model, it would be the whole conductance of that thing. Yeah, and it has some translation into what it means in the temporal domain. Yes. Yep.
So you mentioned that there are some differences in capacity for creating highly focused box states. But is it also, like, how important is it to actually refocus back to the box state for you to have that application, or can it happen in just the boosted state? Without focusing on
the, those
blue arrows.
Oh, you're asking like, can you not use one of these things, but instead use one of these things and achieve the same kind of?
Have some resource.
No, what's at least for the purposes of metrology that I was talking about, what's important is basically that you're like sub-Poissonian. As I say, basically you have a width that's smaller than root n. These things have a width that goes like root n, but this does not.
But But then the application can only last for that very short time. It's a very, very difficult. I would imagine it might be very difficult to do it in an experiment too.
Oh, well, sure. Like if you were like continuing to like have the drive go, and like you had to do your entire like Fock state measurements like right here and nowhere else. But what you can do is you can like evolve to this point and then decouple the qubit from your cavity.
Oh.
Right? Then your cavity is just like, its Hamiltonian is just proportional to n. You preserve this distribution. This thing just becomes like flat and stuck at this like special value. I'm using my finger when I have this pointer.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a good observation. Like yeah, you want to like decouple the qubit once you get to the state you want.
All right, there's no more questions. Thank you again.